From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Chaos broke out at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday as thousands of pro-Trump protesters breached the walls of the federal government building where members of Congress were present to certify the results of the 2020 election. Police were unable to stop them from breaking in as the mostly white men smashed windows and Congress members and their aides huddled inside. The violence came a day after Georgia's Senate runoff races culminated in wins for the Democratic Party, leading it to now gain control of all three governments, chambers of government. My guest is Cliff Albright, the co-founder of Black Voters Matter. He's also a radio host, writer, consultant, and social justice activist. Welcome to the program, Cliff.
Thanks for having me.
So we had booked you to talk about what has been happening in Georgia. You've been one of the main organizers on the ground, part of this incredible movement that has helped to turn Georgia from red to blue. But here we are seeing on Wednesday this violence and chaos from Trump's supporters unfold in the nation's capital. What are your reflections on this day, which is just hard to, I suppose for many is surprising, but for others seems to be a matter of the, you know, chickens coming home to roost?
Yeah, you know, just a couple of reflections, and it's really a story about paradoxes, right? Or contradictions or dichotomies. On the one hand, there's this issue of like just what the reaction was to this protest. I mean, here you have people that are storming the Capitol, they're going into entrances that are supposed to be using, they were supposed to be using metal detectors, and they've got all kinds of objects, including flagpoles and things of that nature, just roaming around the corridors. Imagine, if you would, what it would look like if that was a Black protest, you know, or a Latinx protest storming the Capitol. Even when you look at the protests in the previous days of the Proud Boys and their interactions with police, you know, where it's absent of riot gear, it's absent of pellets, it's absent of tear gas. And so one of the paradoxes is just looking at the different treatment that this protest is receiving compared to, you know, when other groups, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests or anything else have had similar protests, you know, even in spaces that weren't as restricted as the U.S. Capitol, right? You got, you had senators and Congress people literally sheltering in place because of this. And so that's one issue. But then the other issue is, like, what's the spark for this? And the spark is the fact that you've got this group of people based on disinformation, outright lies, that feel like they've had an election stolen, that there's been outright voter fraud. And this is what they're going to, the lengths that they're going to express how displeased they are with the situation, right? Contrast the fake fraud, right? Contrast this reaction to made up news, to made up stories, right? To propaganda and disinformation. Contrast that with the decades, in fact, centuries of real voter suppression that Black communities have faced. The decades and centuries of real closing of polling places, Jim Crow, poll taxes. I mean, you name the whole history as well as the current reality of voter suppression. And yet you've not seen our communities go to this length because of voter suppression. In fact, what's so amazing is that in spite of all the suppression that we've been through, you know, people talk about Black turnout and what does it take to increase Black turnout? The real question isn't what do you need to do to increase Black turnout? The real question is, how is it that in spite of everything that we've been through, that we still continue to turn out in amazing record numbers, much the way that we did in Georgia for this election? So that's an incredible dichotomy, looking at how these folks are responding to fake stories about voter fraud compared to how our communities have responded to real documented examples of voter suppression.
Also a thread that seems to connect what has unfolded on Wednesday in the Capitol and the way in which the Republican Party and Trump's allies have sought to overturn the election seems to be a last dying gasp of of minority rule, of a frightened white population afraid of the voting power, the political power of people of color, of black voters, right? I mean, that's basically what Trump is demanding and his supporters are demanding, that we overturn not just an election, but overturn the will of people, largely people of color.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, they've really been, you know, shameless in the ways that they've targeted communities of color, you know, black communities in particular, in their rationales for why this election needs to be overturned. Like we saw in Michigan, where they went as far as to say that in just one county that they were going to not count a county. In fact, not even a whole county, but within that county to not count with Wayne County, Michigan, to not count Detroit's votes because of alleged irregularities, right? Targeting black voters. We heard on the phone call that Trump had with the Georgia Secretary of State that his biggest obsession was with Fulton County, right? Black voters. All of this in Pennsylvania, they want to not count the turnout in Philadelphia, right? Because Philadelphia must be fraudulent because, again, black voters. So all of this entire, you know, launching of a challenge to the Electoral College results and having this protest and everything that's been coming from the White House is really about, it's not just about overturning democracy. It's, as you said, it's targeted to black voters. As if any election where black voters have successfully used our will and used our electoral power to get the results of our choice, that election almost by definition must be invalid because those black voters, you know, they can't have that much power. That's literally what's the essence of this protest that we've been seeing, and that's the essence of what Trump's complaints and allegations. And it's not just Trump, because I want to be clear about it. And you reported on it. It's Trump. It's over 150 Congress people. It's 12 senators, 12 or 13 senators. It's I forget the number of states that tried to go along with one of his legal cases in order to overturn the election. So there's a significant part of this government at all level, presidential, federal level, and at the state level, and even at the local level, that, you know, they're basically okay with this idea that we could just overturn the election because of the power of black voters. That's going to be something that we have been dealing with, but it's something that we're going to continue to have to deal with even after we have this change in administration.
You mentioned the senators. Ted Cruz of Texas is chief among them, and on Wednesday has been tweeting for the people who he and Trump have egged on to stop, saying those storming the Capitol need to stop now. The Constitution always protects peaceful protest, but violence from the left or right, of course, he had to throw that in, from the left. When has the left ever stormed the Capitol armed? Is always wrong, he says. It's just quite remarkable to see those, and, you know, Mitch McConnell coming out on Wednesday saying that he doesn't support the overturning of the election results, as if he too hadn't been justifying and laying the groundwork and egging on Trump and his supporters for all these weeks since the November 3rd election.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earlier, it's a case of the chickens coming home to roost, right? It's you know, when you live in and when you go around peddling hate and peddling disinformation, right? Peddling confusion. When you go around peddling voter suppression and discrimination, when you do that, it's really only a matter of time before it bounces back on you. It's the same thing that we're seeing, you know, the example that you're giving of Ted Cruz. It's really the same thing that we've seen from Georgia with the Secretary of State, where people in the Secretary of State's office over the past couple of weeks have been complaining about the hate and the hate mail and the threats that they've been getting because Trump and his supporters have been targeting the Georgia officials, right? But what people have lost sight of is the suppression that the Secretary of State has done in Georgia over years is really breeds the same kind of, in other words, they've been, every time they launch a frivolous investigation of a voting rights group, every time they purge voters, every time they try to, locally in Georgia, they created a task force to investigate fraud, which really meant they wanted to investigate voters and investigate voting rights organizations. All of those efforts breed the kind of violence which eventually bounced back on them in the form of Trump supporters targeting the Secretary of State's officials. It's the same thing of the chickens coming home to roost. You can't peddle this type of hate, voter suppression, and discrimination without it at some point becoming uncontrollable and then winding up where now you've got the senators, including those senators that were launching this frivolous challenge, literally having to shelter in place because of what they gave birth to.
And I'm glad you brought up the issue of Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, who has, because he has stood up to Trump on certifying the results of the Georgia elections, has emerged as some sort of protector of election integrity, when of course he, like Governor Brian Kemp, when Kemp was Secretary of State, and even as governor, have tried to suppress the votes at their source. So it's just sort of a different game that they've been playing, and Trump's game is not the same necessarily as theirs in the mechanics of it, but the outcome is quite similar. So let's specifically focus on Georgia. Trump conflated the presidential race on November 3rd in Georgia and the fact that he lost with, you know, he's brought that up repeatedly as Republicans were trying very hard to make the case for why their voters should pick David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. Do you think that the loss by these two Republicans was in part the result of the chaos and confusion sown by Republicans in conjunction with, of course, voter turnout efforts by groups like yours?
Yeah, I really do. I think it was a combination. You know, in some ways, it was a perfect storm that. You know, turns out that when you go around spreading information and trying to convince people that the election is fraudulent and the whole system is rigged, that they might as well not participate, turns out that if you're going to push around that kind of information, some of your supporters may actually listen to you and not come out to vote. Some of it may have been that, right, that strategy that they had of targeting people to say don't come out. Some of it may have just been that people were just so turned off by not just by Trump, but by these two senators. They were basically playing his game and going right along with them. Some of it, you know, we believe some of it may have actually been based on issues, that there may have been some people in the Republican Party, some white voters that just said, you know what, I am kind of upset that y'all found out about COVID. And instead of taking care of the state, the first thing that you did was try to make money off of it. There's any number of reasons and issues that might have kept their turnout from being lower than what they expected it to be. But at the end of the day, just that decrease in turnout would not have been enough if you didn't see simultaneously historic turnout on the part of the Black community. Historic turnout during the early vote and the vote by mail period, where Black voters made up about 33% of the electorate. That's actually higher than what it was in a general election. Historic turnout on Election Day, where same day voting on Election Day, people had been assuming for weeks that Black turnout was going to go down, that the runoff turnout was going to be lower than during the general election. And instead, what we saw was that on Election Day, the same day Election Day voter turnout, Black voter turnout was actually, I think the latest estimate I saw was 19% higher than what it was during the general election. Unheard of for a runoff election. But again, you know, and it's further emphasized by the fact that you had 126,000 voters who voted in a runoff who did not vote in the general election. These were folks, new voters, not just newly registered, but voters that were in some cases already registered, did not participate in the general, but they were so motivated and maybe inspired by the fact that the state had flipped that they then decided to come out and get on the bandwagon and get involved and vote during the runoff. No matter how you slice it, it's very clear. Some people tried to discount whether or not it was the Black vote that made the difference in the general election for Joe Biden. It should not have been a debate after November 3rd, but if it was a debate after November 3rd, it definitely should no longer be a debate, because after this week's election, it's very clear that Black turnout, people of color and turnout overall, right, Black, brown, and even the Asian American, Pacific Islander, but clearly the base of that vote and the base of this historic turnout was Black voters who came out in ways that nobody, not on the Republican side, I even argue not even in the media, nobody really expected, except those of us who have been doing this work. We've been saying for weeks now, based on what we were seeing in the streets, the momentum we were seeing, the conversations we were having, the energy at all of our events, we've been saying for weeks that there was going to be historic turnout, and this week we saw it happen.
And it's also quite, important to note that generally presidential races garner much higher turnouts than a runoff race or a midterm race or, you know, just an off-season, if you will, election. Quite the opposite this time. You mentioned brown voters. I understand that Latino voter registration efforts made a big difference during this election as well. Now, Chris, I want to ask you if you have any explanation, just to get a little bit in into the weeds of the results from Tuesday. We saw Raphael Warnock, first of all, make history as Georgia's first Black senator, beating Kelly Loeffler. His win was decisive. John Ossoff, at least as of you and I speaking, still hasn't been officially declared the winner of the race by many media outlets. Others have declared him. He has declared victory. He would become the current youngest member in the Senate. But the margin of votes, the vote victory of Warnock was obviously much bigger than that for Ossoff. So that means, and of course they were on the same ballot, so that means there were people who voted for Raphael Warnock but didn't vote for John Ossoff. I also understand there were tens of thousands of people who didn't vote for any of the Senate races and just voted for the public commissioner. What was going on there? How do you explain that?
Yeah, so three thoughts. You know, one, just for the record, Sonali, I'm going to let people know, about an hour before Cook Political Report called the Warnock race, and maybe 2 hours before they called the Ossoff race, I had actually called it on my social media, where I let people know, yeah. So I think I was the first one to officially call it. Twitter didn't flag my account the way they flagged the Cook Political Report, but anyway. But on a serious note, you know, It's going to be, you know, it's going to take us some time to get into the numbers to see what it is that was driving that vote gap between Warnock and Ossoff. There was some early speculation that it might have been that you had Black voters that had come out and voted just for Warnock and then decided not to vote for Ossoff. I actually, just as within the past hour of us having this conversation, saw some information that suggested it was a statistical analysis that suggested that it was actually in the white precinct where the Warnock-Ossoff differences, the gap, was actually the most dramatic.
I see.
Which leads us to believe that there were some white voters that chose to vote for Perdue, but chose not to vote for that. It wasn't so much a splitting of the ticket and that they voted for a Democrat and a Republican on the different races, but it was more that they voted for Perdue and then just decided not to vote for Loeffler.
Right, again, and she wasn't elected to that seat. She was appointed to that seat. Perdue, I understand, is a much stronger presence in Georgia politics. Right. He's held that position for a lot longer. Also, is it possible that Raphael Warnock just was, you know, he is a very charismatic leader, bold and visionary and clear in his words. Is it possible that he just garnered more support because perhaps he was a little bit bolder than John Ossoff? You know, John is quite young. Ossoff is quite young.
Yeah, I mean, there's any number of reasons why you could have seen that difference. Some of it could have been that it was, I would like to think that it was the fact that he is bolder by most accounts, you know, more progressive, you know, has a longer history with social justice in general and racial justice in particular. And that fact may have allowed him to get some extra votes that, you know, people may, who just didn't know Ossoff as much, maybe just wouldn't have, didn't feel comfortable voting for him. You know, so it's going to take some time to get into the numbers to really figure that out. But again, we've seen some data that suggests it was more on the white voter side, but it was a drop off. Because as you said, Perdue was elected, Loeffler had been appointed. He's been in politics longer. He's got a known name, right? His cousin was governor and agriculture secretary. And so, you know, he's got a history as an incumbent who had a full term of doing political favors. So there's any number of reasons why Perdue might've got some votes that Loeffler didn't get, or conversely, why Warnock would have gotten some voters that Ossoff didn't get. It's gonna take a minute to figure that out. The other issue that you raised though is really important. I'm glad you raised it. In terms of the Public Service Commission race, because what we again, as part of our theory of change, we often say that there are some folks who it takes a local issue, and by local it could mean city, it could be county, or relatively speaking, it could be a statewide race compared to a federal race or a presidential race. But for some people, that issue of the Public Service Commissioner was more important to them than the Senate race. For some people, the issue of utilities was more important to them than a Senate race that involves a whole myriad of issues, some of which folks may not fully understand, right? And so it's not surprising to us. It's actually part of what we believe is that you've got this traditional notion, traditional wisdom that says the top of the ticket drives turnout all the way down the ticket. And that you know, if anything, you're gonna have people vote for president and then maybe skip some of this local stuff or skip some of these down ballot races. We have found that there are examples, and this is a perfect example. There are folks who they're most passionate about that local issue, about that county race, about that state race, and they will literally vote for that and not get involved in the presidential and not get involved in the Senate race. It's very counterintuitive, but when you understand, particularly for voters that are relatively disengaged, we make the case that the more disengaged the voter is, the more important that their on-ramp, the thing that motivates them to get involved to some degree, is going to be something that's close to them, that they understand. It might be a local issue, or it might be a statewide issue like this Public Service Commission, which although it's statewide, it deals with something that's very daily in their lives, those right. utility issues or those broadband issues. It's counterintuitive, but we've seen this in county after county, state after state.
Cliff, let's talk about big picture with Warnock and Ossoff going to the Senate. The Democrats have 50 seats or will have 50 seats in the Senate. They have a slim majority in the House. And of course, because of having the presidency and the vice presidency, they get control of the Senate. So Mitch McConnell is going to be out as Senate Majority Leader. What would you, as an activist, as a grassroots organizer, say to the Biden administration and to Democratic senators, and even your own, you know, future senators now, that you want them to do on your behalf to represent you as well as possible? What are your asks?
Yeah, I think, you know, those main issues that we had the conversations around, definitely the issue of voting rights, that should be a no-brainer. That should be something that could be got done on day one, right? The John Lewis Voting Rights Act as a first step, because we actually think that we need some stronger protections in terms of voting rights. We need some stronger consequences for those who are found to violate voting rights that may even go beyond what's in the current piece of legislation. But that's something that needs to happen on day one. I'm going to tell you why, Sonali, because after what just took place in Georgia, what took place in this presidential election in general, but in particular, what took place in Georgia, with winning not just the presidential, I mean, sweeping all these federal seats, the presidential and two Senate seats, what we know is that there's going to be an onslaught in terms of voting rights. There's going to be all types of legislation in some of these states, you know, many of which are still controlled by Republican legislatures, but there's going to be an onslaught of legislation to try to curb some of the things that led to this sweeping of these Georgia federal seats. And so it's imperative that Voting Rights Act get dealt with on day one, hour one, minute one. The other thing that we talked about during this election cycle, the George Floyd Act, we need to see action on that immediately. I'll also say, as part of a movement for Black Lives, you know, that the BREATHE Act, which is supported by folks like, you know, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley, as well as others, the BREATHE Act actually goes further on some policing issues. We'd love to see some action on that in Congress, as well as the George Floyd Policing Act. And then obviously, you know, COVID, again, that needs to be something that's day one, minute one, getting the at least the $2,000 payment. Because again,
before the race on Monday, when he spoke, specifically linked the elections of Warnock and Ossoff to the $2,000 stimulus checks. It was the first time he did that.
Yeah, I thought that was big. And you know, it's funny because I've been saying to folks for a couple of weeks, when people ask, oh, should Joe Biden come to Georgia? I said, well, if he comes, he needs to announce something big. Mm. He needs to announce something big, either on COVID or on jobs, you know, or even student, you know, student loan and debt forgiveness. If he announced something about debt forgiveness, I think we might have even seen another 5% uptick in voter right. turnout. And so I was glad to hear him do that. That was a smart move. That's something that he needs to follow up on. Again, hour one, minute one of his presidency to sign 2000. I would say even go further, because, you know, we at some point we got to have a discussion around, you know, is 2000 a one-time payment, or do we do the same thing that some other countries are doing, especially since the U.S. is suffering and our community is suffering from COVID more than any other country. We ought to be doing a response that matches and is bigger than any other country. So maybe we need to be looking at multiple monthly payments of something in the range of $2,000.
Right. Western Europe and Canada have been doing similar things, paying workers to stay home. It keeps them safe. It protects if they're small business owners, enables them to stay afloat. There are many, many good things that come out of it. But of course, we know that our elected officials, Republicans, but unfortunately, even many Democrats are loath to preserve safety nets for Americans. But of course, we're in a different time right now. The the political landscape has changed. Let's see how far these folks can be pushed. Yeah, and then one last question for you, Cliff. What's next, finally, for Georgia voters? I imagine that voters in Georgia want to take some time off. You must be desperately fatigued by elections since last year. But is it time now for when the next gubernatorial elections come about to change the face of the Georgia state legislature? Can it be done now that, you know, you delivered wins for Biden, Warnock, and Ossoff?
I believe, I'm so glad you asked that, Sonali, because I really believe that we're going to be seeing the fruits and the echoes of this victory, these two victories, right? The November 3rd, as well as this week's election. I believe we're going to be seeing the fruits and the ramifications of that, at least for the next couple of years and beyond. You've now got a group of voters all across this state, you know, again, the base being Black voters, but also with our friends and partners in other communities. You've got a group of voters that now really see what their power looks like. They really see what our ability is to take over or to win elections, right? And I think that when we get into these state legislative races, there are a lot of legislative seats. You know, we have legislative seats that often go unchallenged in some of these communities, even oddly enough in communities where we've actually got some significant numbers where we can actually have an impact. I think what you're going to see is an incredible crop of candidates. They're going to try to compete all across the state for these legislative seats. I think you're going to see voters that are actually energized. I think if we connect these two issues, right, accountability for these federal elections, right, if Biden and these senators and this Congress actually act on some legislation that lets people see, you know what, I came out and voted. We made history by winning a state. And then after making history, we saw action. If you have that trifecta, if you have those three things take place at the federal level, it's only going to be a matter of time where at the state level, people say, you know what? We can do the same thing at the state level. We actually have the power to win some of these legislative seats, to get action on Medicaid expansion, to get action on some other issues that our communities desperately want to see progress on. So we're going to be seeing the echoes of this victory for years to come, starting with these state legislative races that we're going to see in a couple of years here, and the gubernatorial race, where I wouldn't be surprised if we see somebody named Abrams on a ticket.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, folks. Cliff, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
My guest has been Cliff Albright. He's the co-founder of Black Voters Matter, radio host, writer, consultant, social justice activist, and a frequent guest on our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.